From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
The S&P 500 stock index sets a new record for the longest bull market in history, 3,453 days. Wow. What does that tell us about the economy? As trade tensions, the trade war, seems to be ebbing a bit. Are we looking at a trade peace on the horizon? And the administration, the Trump administration, issues its draft rule replacing the Clean Power Plan of the Obama administration. Is that going to succeed, and what does it mean? My name is Paul Gigot with The Wall Street Journal, and I'm here with my esteemed colleagues, Kim Strassel. How are you, Kim?
Hello.
And James Freeman, author of Best of the Web Today. How are you, James?
Good. Thanks, Paul.
All right. So let's start here with the S&P 500 record. In a way, it's not an important milestone. In any larger sense, although it does tell us a couple of things, James. One, this has been a very long and resilient recovery, and it tells us that maybe because stock prices are up, maybe it has some room to run.
Yeah, I think when anyone looks at the chart and they see since spring of 2009 this beautiful upward march of stock prices, maybe they think, well, the trends don't go on forever. Maybe this is time to expect a downturn. And absolutely, trends don't go on forever. But I think in some ways you can make a case for an optimism maybe more grounded in realism, in the sense that for a long time after the financial crisis, the Federal Reserve was taking extreme measures to try and lift the values of assets of all kinds.
Including stocks.
Yeah. And they have not completely unwound all those measures. They've really hardly begun in terms of the Fed still has a huge balance sheet. Interest rates have come up a little, but not a huge amount. But I think the reason maybe to be encouraged is that we're seeing kind of the handoff from government to private markets. It was Washington trying to conjure higher asset prices and often succeeding for years. And I think this last year and a half, 2 years has been more about first optimism and then the fulfilled expectations of faster growth and much higher corporate profits.
Yeah, we saw since Election Day, Kim, in 2016. That's when stock prices really did pop on that change in tone, if you will, that people thought the Trump administration might bring. And then that has leveled off to some extent after a pretty good increase. But let's look back to 2009 when the recession, when the stock market bottom hit. The S&P was at 666 points. Now it's well over 2,800. I dare say that if you got out of the market when it was 700, you paid a fearsome price in foregone asset appreciation, which I think goes to show you that even though it's painful for a while in recessions, it pays to stick with the equity markets.
Exactly. It's good news for all of those investors out there, which of course make up an increasing number of the American public, 401ks and other people planning for retirement. But I think to reiterate James's point, if you go back, the last time you had a bull market that ran this long, it was from October 1990, which ended with the bursting of the tech bubble in March 2000. And the point there being that people understood that that was a bubble, that a lot of the stocks that were driving the market at the time were overvalued. It was not sustainable. And the good news here, when you look at where we are with this bull market, is that, yeah, there have been some corrections. It was a pretty painful month in February. A lot of people will remember because we did have a minor correction, or actually a fairly dramatic correction after the market popped, as you said, on Election Day, and it came back down. But if you go back to that time, a lot of people were pointing out that stocks did look overvalued. You're not hearing people say that so much now. The relative strength of the corporate profits that are coming in, relative strength of a lot of the stocks that you see seem to be in line with the economic factors that we have at play, the tax cuts. And people feel that those tax cuts and some of the other positive things coming out of the administration, in particular deregulation, still have a ways to go in terms of helping the economy, and that's all leading to a more sustainable bull market.
And James, one of the fears, one of the concerns that I've had as it relates to your point about the Federal Reserve targeting asset prices, and when they did that, I mean, the explicit purpose of the quantitative easing and zero interest rates was to create a wealth effect. Mm-hmm. So that people would – they weren't getting anything from their bank accounts. They weren't getting anything from their savings. So what would they do? They'd go out and find yield, yep. right? And to get yield, you'd go to stocks. You go to higher risk assets. And the question has been, and I don't think anybody knows the answer, is how much of that long bull run was related to the Fed and the Fed policy? Yep. And the question was, okay, well, if – the Fed policy worked on the way up, the asset price, would then, as they unwound that policy, would it begin – would it affect asset prices? And you maybe see that some of that's been working in the flatness of the market. This hasn't – we haven't had the big increase this year, for example. And yet, as you point out, earnings – Kim pointed out, are really good.
Yeah.
And maybe that is underpinning the stock price, even though we're not seeing a huge appreciation, underpinning the stock prices despite the Fed unwinding.
Yeah. I think during the period where a lot of the Obama era, you had a very good market, a very good environment for people who owned financial assets and kind of lousy in every other way. It was slow growth. Not a lot of gains in wages, obviously not, as you pointed out, not a great time for people living on a fixed income or who wanted to get some kind of interest on their bank savings accounts. And I think as far as businesses, we wonder during that whole period as they, I think, worked hard to churn out earnings without a lot of growth, how much of this is the Fed just creating money and how much is American business being resilient and finding ways to cut costs, to do things more efficiently, to continue to see these gains in the equity market. And I do think now, because the new phenomenon is not just companies being clever about acquisitions or about maintaining low costs or cutting costs, it's top line revenue growth, bigger markets, bigger sales. And that's what I think has people more optimistic. But also, as we've said, when you're growing earnings this quickly, it's a lot harder to say that these prices are unreasonable. Now, it's also unlikely, given history, that companies continue to grow earnings 20% a year. That won't last forever. But obviously, you can go well south of that and still have a very healthy bunch of companies and healthy market.
Another dampening influence on the stock market, Kim, in recent months has been trade policy. The president's introduced a fair bit of uncertainty on trade with China, NAFTA, Europe, car tariffs, and so on. And in recent days, there has been some more optimism that maybe we'll get a settlement of some of these. Maybe we'll get a breakout of, dare we say, trade peace. U.S. and Mexico are close, and by all accounts, to revising NAFTA. Canada seems to be on the outs for now, but might come in. But Mexico would be a big deal. The U.S. and EU, European Union, are on a truce on auto tariffs. Now, the word this morning, the administration may hold off on car tariffs as the negotiations continue. And then perhaps most surprising, the administration is sending a delegation from the Treasury led by our contributor, David, former contributor David Malpass, to negotiate with the Chinese with a goal of laying out some trade agreements that President Trump and President Xi Jinping could agree to in November. All of that's contributed to, I think, this latest bounce in the market.
Yeah, and let's hope that the president is watching. I mean, this is, of course, a president. We've warned him against this, about pinning too much on what the stock market is doing on any given day or taking credit for it. Because if you take credit for it, you also have to take responsibility for it when it drops. And we have seen the effects of all of this saber rattling on trade affecting the market. It's going to be really important to watch just in the next few days about whether this is just a temporary lull or if this is going to reverberate back in the market again. Because, you know, even as they are sending over these delegation to China and you're having this good news on Mexico and the EU, you know, at the very same time, we're starting 6 days of hearings that the U.S. Trade Rep's office is doing, in which he's talking about an additional $200 billion worth of sanctions on Chinese goods. A lot of companies are testifying at those hearings, corporate CEOs explaining just how damaging that would be to their businesses. So we're not out of the woods yet. But to the extent that it seems that the White House has acknowledged at least a little bit that trade peace is indeed a lot better than complete trade uncertainty and a war of words and sanctions, I mean, not sanctions, tariffs, that would be a good sign.
Yeah, the key point is with Trump, there's just the Trumpian uncertainty. You never know what he's going to do on trade, which is all the more reason that if he could get some kind of agreement with these countries, it would, I think, be a big help to the economy. Remove what I think has been a pall over at least to some degree over stock prices and some corporate investment decisions. All right. We're talking about the American economy and stocks, and you're listening to Potomac Watch from The Wall Street Journal.
This message comes from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, destination-focused dining, and cultural enrichment on board and on shore. And every Viking voyage is all-inclusive with no children and no casinos. Discover more at Viking.com.
Spend time with Alexa? You can now listen to Potomac Watch on your Amazon device. Just enable the skill and ask Alexa to play Potomac Watch from The Wall Street Journal.
From the opinion pages of The Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Welcome back. I'm Paul Gigot with James Freeman and Kim Strassel. Let's turn to the big regulatory news this week and the political news as well. The Trump administration issuing the draft at long last of their new rule that repeals the Clean Power Plant rule of the Obama administration handling power plants and emissions from carbon emissions and in particular, that had targeted coal plants for extinction, try to drive coal out of the American economy, the American energy mix. And the Trump administration is now rewriting that rule, has issued the draft. Kim, what's your big takeaway from this new draft rule?
So this is great because it is still going to be very effective in terms of environmental policy and clean air, which is the idea behind the Clean Air Act. But at the same time, it's going to be much better for consumers. It's going to be a lot more affordable. It's still going to protect the environment. It's going to save jobs. The fundamental point of what they've done here. So this new rule they're calling the Affordable Clean Energy Rule. Remember, the Clean Power Plan, which is what the Obama people had put forward, was stayed by the United States Supreme Court because almost immediately upon it being issued, a number of states, more than almost two dozen states, sued and said that it exceeded the Clean Air Act and the powers that the EPA had. So it never went into effect. This one is designed to, in fact, be legal, and it basically does two important things. One, it gives states a lot more discretion over how they regulate coal-fired power plants. But I think the other one, and that's really important, is that when you have a power plant and you want to upgrade it and, in fact, make it more efficient, we have this thing, if it's considered a major modification, it triggers a new source review. It makes it very costly and difficult to then upgrade those plants. The former Obama rule had very specifically made it easier to trigger those as a way of basically running coal plants since out of existence. This new rule will change the definition of what's a major modification, and that's going to give states a lot more ability to allow their coal plants to upgrade, become more efficient without driving them out of business.
The wrap on it, of course, James, is that this is essentially a free ride for carbon polluters. It is going to try to salvage a coal industry that should be destined for extinction because of the damage it does with carbon emissions, and also the coal can't survive anyway because of the changes in the natural gas development of shale fracking. So this essentially amounts to a kind of a subsidy for coal. What's your response?
Well, I think there was a question of whether you should let the market do what it does, which is continues to replace coal with natural gas, with lower emitting natural gas, or whether you as a policy want to kill coal immediately, which was more of the Obama strategy. But I think it's—
That was the Obama strategy.
Yeah, and I think this is in part— part of a larger history, which is the U.S. economy gets more efficient and uses less energy and emits less per dollar of GDP over time, regardless of whatever regulatory regime has to be in place at the moment. But I think there's no reason to think that gas isn't going to remain a very formidable competitor. It's cheap, and at this point seems almost a limitless supply in the United States. So I think a big coal revival is unlikely. But some of those jobs probably remain a little longer than they otherwise would.
You know who has played a big role in helping the American coal industry over the last year or so? Kim and James, you both know the answer to this. It's called the Federal Republic of Germany. Germany has suddenly had to import enormous amounts of coal because their renewable policies had raised the price of energy so spectacularly, and also had limitations because they had sometimes the wind doesn't blow, and sometimes in Germany, actually a lot of the times in Germany, the sun doesn't shine, and particularly northern Germany. And of course, Angela Merkel, the chancellor, had after the Yakushima disaster in Tokyo, had made a decision to close all their nuclear plants. So, what do you have to substitute? And by the way, they don't use a lot of natural gas there. Coal.
Yeah.
So the greenest of greens in Europe are actually using a lot more coal than they did.
Yeah, the reality is that there's still a big market for coal all across the world. And the U.S. industry may end up exporting more of it, because the reality is, look, this new plan is not likely to change the plans that most energy producing companies have, electrical utilities, et cetera, for building new plants. Most of them are going with natural gas because it's cheaper, makes more sense. It's more stable in the long term, they think, in terms of prices and regulations. So that's not going to change that. But to get back to your point about whether or not this is a subsidy, that's the claim. No, this is just allowing coal to continue to compete in energy markets. And it is remarkable, the degree to which Obama administration officials have now come out of the woodwork and are admitting that, in fact, that was their goal. They were, you know, sly about it at the time. This is all just about reducing CO2 emissions. No, it was to shut down the coal industry completely. And you have, for instance, the EPA pointing out that under their new plan, coal plants will be more efficient than they are now, and they will reduce carbon dioxide emissions. It won't be as incredibly dramatic and almost unachievable and economy strangling as the Obama regulation would have been, but they will still reduce emissions. And in response to that, you've seen all these Obama officials say, yeah, but that's not the point. We shouldn't have any coal at all, and you screwed up our plan for that.
Well, that's right. And I think power plants around the country, power companies, are still going to invest in renewables. There's still enormous subsidies that exist for several years out now for wind energy, for solar energy. And those market, those subsidies are not going away, I don't believe, anytime soon, and maybe not ever. So companies are still going to take advantage of that to develop that those energy sources. But you need a baseload. You need a supply of energy that's reliable for baseload power. That is at peak times for air conditioning in the summer, heating in the winter. And you don't have a lot of choices for that. It's either got to be coal, nuclear, or it's got to be natural gas because they're more reliable, and particularly with coal and nuclear, because they, you know, even natural gas depends on pipeline supplies and prices at any given time.
Yeah, people want to keep the lights on. I think that's the that's the message from Germany and here. Whether or not you want coal to be a big percentage of our energy portfolio going forward, I think you never know what happens to supplies. And obviously with the renewables, there's an availability question for much of the day or much of the year, depending on where you are. But you, as you get into the politics, Americans generally don't rate the climate concern as highly as people who write about the climate do. And I think there's still a sales job in terms of what is the long-term impact exactly. And even if you accept certain dire scenarios, what is the best way to respond? Do you grow your economy as fast as you can now and count on technology to develop solutions 50, 80 years whenever they're required, or do you want to put limits on growth at this point and accept much higher energy costs?
We should add that this will be challenged in court undoubtedly once it's finalized in 90 days with whatever adjustments are made based on the comment period. It will be challenged in court. There is no guarantee that it will survive, although I think chances, given its relative modesty, is that it probably will survive. But then, of course, you have an election in 2020, and after that, everything could change again. Kim, what do you think the prospects are for its survival?
Well, it'll be litigated, but I do think that, look, the Supreme Court was pretty quick in saying that the prior rule, they put a stay on it because very good points were raised that it exceeded the EPA's authority. And I do know for a fact that the EPA, in crafting this rule, has tried very hard to make sure. Remember, this is an agency that until recently was under the administration of Scott Pruitt, who he had to leave after a lot of ethics complaints and scandals. But this guy was a lawyer who cared very much about imposing a new kind of legal requirement on the EPA to comply with statutes as they are written. And there was a lot of attention within EPA to try to get this one right and make sure that whatever they put out would withstand a legal attack and assault.
All right, Kim, thank you. James, thank you. Thank you all for listening. Paul, we'll be back tomorrow with another edition of Potomac Watch.